Hey everybody, welcome back to the Curiosity Chronicles. 59 years ago to the day, President John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, Texas. And on the Curiosity Chronicles, today I'm talking about in detail what happened on that day 59 years ago. November 22, 1963. Originally, I was going to do a three-part series on the Kennedy assassination, but as I suspected, I'm going to lengthen that by one episode. I'm going to do four. This episode was originally going to be a detailed timeline of November 22 and then a summary of Oswald's guilt or the evidence that is presented, which I believe shows Oswald is guilty. But as I dug into this, I realized that there's a lot of details that I could get into just on the timeline, and I didn't want to cheapen this. This is a subject matter that I'm very passionate about, and I hope by diving into detail, I can convey that passion and make this episode really worth listening to. So let's dive into it. November 22, 1963. My name is Brett Bielsma. I'm the host of the Curiosity Chronicles, and this is what I was curious about this month. One quick note before we jump into the timeline. Obviously, by the nature of this episode, there are a lot of times mentioned, and I wanted to point out that every time in this episode is Dallas time, Central Standard Time. So I want to make sure I'm clear on that, just so no wires get crossed anywhere. Central Standard Time for this entire episode. So I mentioned last episode that Lee Harvey Oswald was not living with his wife Marina during this time in late November. He was living close to Dallas, and his wife Marina was living with an acquaintance, Ruth Payne, in Irving, Texas. Now, on the weekends, often Lee would catch a ride out to Irving and stay with his family for the weekend. But on November 21, a Thursday, he asked Wesley Frazier for a ride out to Irving, which was very uncharacteristic. Never, well, maybe one time, I think, in the entire time that they were living apart, had Oswald ever gone out to Irving when it wasn't a Friday or Saturday. So it was uncharacteristic. So November 22 rolls around, 12:30 a.m. Marina is in bed with Oswald, and she realizes that Oswald is still awake. He's very restless. He seems anxious. Has something on his mind, clearly. That wouldn't hold up in court. That's hearsay. But he's still awake and very restless. Finally gets some sleep. 6:30 rolls around. Oswald gets out of bed. He has to get ready for work, catch a ride back to Dallas with Wesley Frazier. And he is talking to Marina. And very uncharacteristically, he gives her all the money that he has in his wallet, $170. And tells her, to buy whatever she thinks the children need. This is very uncharacteristic as well. Oswald usually is extremely money conscious and does not part with his money easily, buying only the necessities. So Marina is caught off guard, but she thinks that maybe this is a step in the right direction for their marriage. Later on, after he leaves, she finds the $170. She also finds his wedding ring that he leaves in a cup on the bureau. Again, I mentioned this last episode. This is just rehashing some things. Lee catches a ride with Wesley Frazier, and when he gets in the car, he is carrying a long package that is wrapped in a homemade brown paper bag. When asked about it, he says it is curtain rods for his new apartment, and he puts it in the back seat. Wesley Frazier's sister inside the house also sees him place his package in the back seat, but she does not know anything about it because she's in the house. Wesley Frazier also notices that Lee Oswald, for the first time that he can recollect, does not have a lunch. So he noted that and asked what Lee was going to do for lunch. He said he'd buy something at the cafeteria. 7 a.m., President John F. Kennedy is at the Hotel Texas in Fort Worth. He's getting ready. This is a campaign trip to Dallas, Texas. There was some infighting. I'm not going to go into details too much, but there's some infighting between Texas politicians like Governor Connally and others within the Democratic Party. Kennedy is basically on a fence-mending mission and hoping to shore up the South and the state of Texas for his reelection bid in 1964. So he's making a lot of stops at this point at 7 a.m. He is still in Fort Worth. The plan is to make a speech outside the hotel and then make a speech at the Chamber of Commerce and then jump a short flight on Air Force One from Fort Worth to Dallas, Texas. Now, while getting ready, Kennedy has a newspaper, the Dallas Morning News. So despite being in Fort Worth, he has the Dallas Morning News, and he sees what has now become the infamous ad that was taken out in that particular newspaper. It is an ad accusing him of treason, pro-communism, and because it had a black border around it, it was designed to look like an obituary, which is very ominous, but Kennedy does not think anything of it. His wife is alarmed because it seems like an obvious threat, but JFK kind of shrugs it off and tells his wife, Jackie, quote, "Oh, you know, we are heading into nut country today," end quote. So the weather in Texas had not been very pleasant for the time that Kennedy had been there so far, but on 10 a.m. on this Friday, rainy weather had started to clear up, and the advanced Secret Service agent, Wynn Lawson, who was on the advance team in Dallas, Texas, takes the bubble top off the presidential limo. The limo had a clear top that could protect the occupants from the weather if it was raining or snowing or very windy. But as much as possible, Kennedy ordered that that bubble top should not be on the limousine. He wanted it to be the open convertible so that he was visible to the crowds and able to get every last drop of campaigning energy out of this trip. So Wynn Lawson orders that the bubble top be taken off the limousine in Dallas, and this was done basically on Kennedy's orders. Now, another thing about the limousine is equipped with little steps on the back and handles on the back so that Secret Service agents could ride on the limousine as a protective detail. Kennedy has ordered as much as possible that the Secret Service agents do not stand on that step, despite the fact that that was their procedure. He wanted to be as visible as possible, and he also did not want to look like he was being guarded 24/7. He wanted to look like more of your everyday man, even though he was the most powerful person in the world at this point. 10:30 a.m., Kennedy returns to his suite in the Hotel Texas and prepares to leave for Dallas. He is done with his campaigning in Fort Worth. And there were some weird, quirky comments. I've read in multiple different biographies of Kennedy that he was a bit of a fatalist, and he had, not premonitions per se, but a gut instinct that he was not going to live a long and happy life. He was very unhealthy, not by anything that he did, but he had issues, like I've said, with his back. He had Addison's disease, and he was on many medications. He presented a very vibrant and healthy lifestyle to the voters and the American people, but in private, he was actually usually in quite a bit of pain and had very serious health complications. So he had this fatalistic approach to life, according to some of his biographers, and that comes through in Fort Worth when he's getting ready to go to Dallas. He made a remark to Jackie, quote, "You know, last night would have been a hell of a night to assassinate a president," end quote. And he was talking about the motorcade they took through Fort Worth because it was dark, it was very windy and rainy, and they did stop at times to mingle with crowds, and he mentioned how easy it would have been for someone either in the crowd or with a rifle to take a shot at him and escape because of the weather and the crowds. And he had mentioned on multiple occasions to Jackie that as much as the Secret Service were good at their jobs, someone with a high-powered rifle could kill the president quite easily. Very strange, now looking back, of course, comments that were just made off the cuff. Jumping ahead, 11:25 a.m., Air Force One leaves Fort Worth to fly to Dallas. Now, it is a very short distance from Fort Worth to Dallas. They could have easily driven. It was only a 13-minute flight, but Kennedy's aides, especially Dave Powers and Ken O'Donnell, his close friends and his presidential advisors, wanted to fly to Dallas, Texas, specifically Love Field, because they knew that landing and coming off of Air Force One with crowds cheering and waving and giving a short speech at Love Field was a very important thing to do when you're campaigning to be reelected for president. The photo opportunity of an adoring crowd cheering on the very healthy and young looking Jack Kennedy and his wife Jackie, who is also very beautiful and beloved by the American people, was just an opportunity they could not pass up. So 11:47 a.m., stock boys at the Texas School Book Depository, which of course is where Lee Harvey Oswald works, are reflooring the sixth floor. And at one point, one of them, Bonnie Ray Williams, thinks he sees Oswald messing around with some boxes about a half an hour before lunch. Now, he doesn't think anything of this, and he can't even be sure that it's Oswald because he doesn't really take notice. Oswald is often on the sixth floor filling orders for books, and he's often messing around and moving boxes around. At 11:55 a.m., the motorcade leaves Love Field, where Air Force One landed, and they begin to make their way through Dallas, heading towards the Trade Mart, where there is going to be a political event and speeches given by President Kennedy and others. Now, the motorcade was substantial. This makeup of the motorcade is worth getting into here a little bit. So the pilot car is driven by Deputy Chief George Lumpkin, and it's a scout, basically. They go about a quarter mile ahead, and they are looking for any accidents or emergencies like fires or riots, in the very rare cases, that would cause them to have to do a last-minute detour to avoid any type of emergency. After the scout car, or the pilot car, there were two-wheel Dallas police motorcycles under command of S.Q. Bella. There was three of them. And then there was, after that, five two-wheel motorcycles under the command of Sergeant Stavis Ellis. And then you get into the actual meat of the motorcade. It's the lead car. It's an unmarked white Ford police sedan driven by Dallas Police Chief Jesse Curry. And with Curry in that lead car are Secret Service agents Winston Lawson and Forrest Sorrells. And then five car lengths back from the lead car is the presidential limousine. Now, the presidential limousine has two motorcycles flanking out on each side. There are no Secret Service agents on the running board for the majority of the motorcade procession because Kennedy, as I said earlier, was sick of seeing bodyguards whenever he turned to look at the crowd. The Secret Service agent driving the presidential limousine is named Bill Greer. Now, Jack Kennedy are in the very back seat. The presidential limousine had the back seat where the president and his wife generally sat, and then a middle row of jump seats, and in this case, that's where Governor Connally and his wife Nellie were, and then the front seats where the Secret Service agents would be. So Jackie is on the left in the very back seat, Kennedy is on the right, and if you ever see pictures or videos, he is all the way over to the right with his arm kind of on the window hanging out of the limousine. The jump seat in front of Kennedy is Governor Connally and his wife. He's the governor of Texas, of course. Now, the jump seat is a little bit lower, and Governor Connally is to the left of Kennedy, which is important detail. He is not directly in front of Kennedy. He's a little bit to the left and lower. After the presidential limousine is the Secret Service follow-up car. That car is codenamed Halfback. And that is driven by Sam Kinney, and the commander of the car, Emery Roberts, is in the passenger seat. Clint Hill, who was the head of Jackie Kennedy's detail, is on the left running board along with Bill McIntyre, who's behind him. And on the right running board are John Reddy and Paul Landis. The Secret Service follow-up car also is where Kennedy advisors Dave Powers and Ken O'Donnell are. They're in the right and left jump seat. And in the very back of that car in the seats are George Hickey and Glenn Bennett. They are Secret Service agents. And between them is an AR-15 223 caliber rifle. Then after halfback is the vice president's limousine, which of course has Lyndon Johnson and his wife Lady Bird. Totally blanked on his name for some reason. And then there's another Secret Service follow-up car. And then a whole bunch of other cars, various news and camera cars, congressmen, governor, aides, more motorcycles, White House press bus, local press, etc., etc., etc. I mean, it's a huge motorcade making its way through Dallas. Obviously, nobody cares about anything going on except for the presidential limousine. But it's important to realize what the makeup is just to get a picture in your mind of what's happening in Dallas. Now, it's 12 p.m. at this point. Charlie Givens, he's a stock boy at the Texas School Book Depository, realizes that he forgot his cigarettes. He was reflooring the sixth floor, and he needed to go up, get his cigarettes from the sixth floor before they went down for lunch. And he's surprised because he finds Oswald on the fifth floor. Oswald says he's not going down for lunch, and he asks that when Givens goes down on the west freight elevator, that he close the gate. The gate had to be closed so that the elevator could be called up to a floor or sent down to a floor. So Oswald obviously was looking forward to needing the elevator. He asked Givens to make sure the gate was closed so he could call it up to him. Givens forgot. 12.06 p.m., the motorcade is at Lemon and Lomo Alto Drive, and the president has Bill Greer stop the limousine because he sees a group of children holding up a sign that says, "Mr. President, will you please shake our hand?" So he stops, shakes hands, and then they continue on their way. He spends about 5-6 minutes shaking hands with the kids. There's also another time later on where he sees a group of, I believe, Catholic school children there with their nun. Kennedy, of course, is the first Catholic president ever elected, so he spends some time shaking hands and basically campaigning by having a photo opportunity with the nun and the Catholic school children. But overall, the motorcade is making fairly good time throughout Dallas. 12:15 p.m., the motorcade is about 2 miles away from Dealey Plaza, and Arnold Rowland and his wife Barbara, incidentally, his wife, they are both in high school. It just blows my mind. This is like the one moment of levity in this entire episode. I was doing the research on this, and this wasn't a fluke. It's not his girlfriend. His wife, Arnold Rowland, and his wife Barbara, were still, I believe, seniors in high school and married. The 60s were wild, man. They went to high school, were married, and then he had a part-time job at like a pizza place or something like that. What in the world? Anyway, they are finding a place to watch the motorcade in Dealey Plaza. And because obviously the motorcade is not there yet, they had some time to just kind of chill and look around. Arnold later said that he spotted a man holding a high-powered rifle across his chest in the window on the west end of the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository. Now, despite the fact that the rifleman is back in shadow, Arnold, who had better than 20/20 vision, could clearly see that he was a slender man in his early 30s, roughly, and he had a light complexion and close-cut dark hair or hair that was very well combed. Now, other than the age, this is a very good, albeit minimal, description of Lee Harvey Oswald. Arnold tells his wife, Barbara, "Hey, look in that window and you can see a Secret Service agent." But by the time she looks, she can't see the man that Arnold sees, and Arnold kind of forgets about him. At 12:29 p.m., the motorcade, and specifically the presidential limousine, makes the turn from Maine onto Houston, and for the first time is visible to the crowd in Dealey Plaza, which bursts into thunderous applause. Nellie Connolly, of course the wife of the governor, turns around and says to Jack Kennedy, quote, "Mr. President, they can't make you believe now that there are not some in Dallas that love you and appreciate you, can they?" End quote. To which JFK responded, quote, "No, they sure can't," end quote. Grinning ear from ear, obviously things were going very well from a political standpoint. And from just a personal standpoint, who does not like thunderous applause directed their way? So the entire presidential party, Secret Service agents who are definitely wary and always on edge, are happy with how things are proceeding. Kennedy is ecstatic how things are proceeding. And Jackie, who has been going through a very rough time, I believe it's only been about 4 months since their youngest son, Patrick, died shortly after birth. And she's been going through quite a depressive episode. She's just barely starting to come out of it for this Dallas trip. She is having a fantastic time as well. Honestly, the saddest thing in this whole sordid affair is Jackie Kennedy, if you ask me. Just tragic. Anyway, the motorcade makes the hairpin turn onto Elm Street and is starting to approach the triple underpass. They are 5 minutes away from their destination at the Trade Mart. And that is when all hell breaks loose. At 12:30 and 0 seconds p.m., the first shot rings out, but because of the crowd noise, the motorcycle noise, and the general confusion, many people are not aware that it is even a gunshot. Bonnie Ray Williams, Harold Norman, and James Jarman, who are three of the stock boys at the Texas School Book Depository, watching out the windows on the fifth floor, think that it is a firearm salute for the president or possibly a motorcycle backfire. There are other people that think it may be a firecracker or just some mischievous kids. Virgie Rachley, a bookkeeper, also from the Texas School Book Depository, sees sparks fly off the pavement in the far left lane right behind the limousine and is one of the people that believes that some idiot threw a firecracker into the motorcade. Howard Brennan, a man also watching from Dealey Plaza, looks up and sees a man in the sixth floor window aiming a rifle toward the limousine. Howard Brennan is one of the few people that right from the get-go realized that it was a rifle shot. He sees the man from the waist up, rifle against his right shoulder, deliberately and without panicking, rack another bullet with the bolt action and take aim. At 12:30 p.m. in 3.5 seconds, so 3.5 seconds later, there is a second shot. The sound of that shot is loud enough that loose plaster dust falls from the ceiling onto Bonnie Ray Williams and some of the other stock boys watching from the fifth floor. After this shot, the president stiffens and his hands swoop to his throat. He assumes a position called the Thorburn's position. It is with the hands by his throat and elbows almost straight out perpendicular to the neck, and it is a common neurological reflex position when there is a spinal injury. Think of someone kind of doing chicken wings, except their hands are not quite clutching their throat, but are right under their chin, arms sticking straight out and then bending at the elbows. In the follow-up car, Agent Glenn Bennett immediately notices that the president is hit, and George Hickey is already grabbing the AR-15 between them and looking towards the right rear where he has believed the shots are coming from. At this point, with the second shot, the Secret Service agents are well aware of what is happening. Clint Hill, on the follow-up car, jumps off the follow-up car and starts running as fast as he can towards the presidential limousine. Roy Kellerman, who is in the president's limo, turns back to his right and believes he hears the president at that point say, "My God, I am hit." Kellerman also notices at this point that Governor Connolly is also wounded. When the second shot rang out, Governor Connolly was turning to look at the president when he feels a hard blow in his right side of his back, which drives him down into his seat, and he has what he can see is a sucking chest wound, and he cries out, "My God, they're going to kill us all." Greer, the driver of the presidential limousine, turns around, slightly slowing because he turns around, and sees Governor Connally slumping down and hears Kellerman yell, "Let's get out of here, we're hit." These are all direct quotes. At 12:30 and 8.4 seconds, the final shot rings out. It's 8.4 seconds after the first shot, as best as people can piece together the timeline. With this shot, the right side of the president's head explodes. Abraham Zapruder, who is filming everything from Dealey Plaza, gets the entire thing on film, and it is not for the faint of heart. I have watched it many, many times. It's brutal. Jackie is checking on Kennedy when the final headshot hits. She's about 6 inches from his face when he is shot in the head, which I imagine is the most traumatic event a human being can go through, possibly. And as he is hit, he topples onto her shoulder, and Governor Connally hears Jackie exclaim, "They've killed my husband. I have his brains in my hand." Clint Hill, who was running towards the presidential limousine, had just grabbed on to, or was just about to grab onto, the handhold of the limousine when the third shot hit. Now, Clint Hill is a fascinating man. I highly recommend you look into him if you have the time. He was the Secret Service agent for 5 presidents, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, and Gerald R. Ford. I was totally blanking on the order there. I hope I got that right. And he, at this time, was the head of Jackie Kennedy's detail. He became very close with Jackie Kennedy. He suffered an immense amount of guilt and PTSD for many years after the Kennedy assassination, because he felt that if he had reacted just a second or two earlier, that he could have saved Kennedy's life by giving his own life and taking the third bullet himself. Fairly heroic thoughts. He became alcoholic and suicidal, even, for not being the one killed and saving the president's life, which there was nothing he could do. He has all this guilt because it was his job to protect the president, and I can understand that, but he is an American hero. He did everything he could. He was one of the first to react, and he is a great man who not many people know about. Now, he did overcome his depression, his alcoholism, and his suicidal tendencies, and after being offered a promotion in 1975, he decided that he was actually going to retire from the Secret Service and go about different paths, including writing some fantastic memoirs that detail his time with the 5 presidents that he served under, as well as Jackie Kennedy. I really highly recommend, if you're interested, to check it out. But Clint Hill, American hero. Now, as the car starts speeding to the hospital, Clint Hill is able to get onto the back of the limousine and throw himself over top of Jackie Kennedy, as well as the president, who is obviously grievously wounded, and he has a close-up view of the carnage in the back of the limo. And once he gets a good look, he turns to the Secret Service follow-up car, shakes his head, and gives a thumbs down. Chaos and confusion are reigning in Dealey Plaza. People are pointing out anything and everything that they think might be connected. Police are searching multiple areas because they have no idea what is going on at this point. And they are running up to the grassy knoll and the train yard and searching all of these places, which will lead to conspiracy theories in the future. But we will get to that later in a different episode. But just know that is absolute chaos and panic in Dealey Plaza. Now, at this point, it's 12:31 p.m. The limo is speeding at a high rate to Parkland Hospital. Jackie is cradling the president's head, basically in her lap. And later, she says, quote, "I kept holding the top of his head down, trying to keep his brains in, but I knew he was dead." End quote. Now, on the second floor of the depository, Dallas police officer Marion Baker confronts Lee Harvey Oswald, but after finding out that he worked at the building, he continues up to where he thinks the shots came from, which I believe was initially the fifth floor. Again, it's total chaos and panic. Nobody knows what's going on. At 12:36 p.m., police officers seal off the Texas School Book Depository after multiple witnesses claim that the shots were coming from that building. However, because of the chaos and panic, the initial witnesses gave differing descriptions of the shooter, but there were multiple descriptions of that shooter. And initially, it was not clear if the shots came from the fourth, fifth, or the sixth floor. So police officers just sealed off the entire building and started doing what needed to be done to try to bring some order to the scene. The limousine at the same time arrives at Parkland Hospital. Dave Powers runs up to the limo from the follow-up car and sees that Kennedy's eyes are open. Initially, he sees this in that first split second as a good sign. The president is conscious and awake. But unfortunately, after that split second, he realizes that no, the president's eyes are open, but they're open in a vacant, fixed stare. Jackie Kennedy refuses to release the president to the Secret Service agents and the doctors, claiming that she doesn't want to leave him and that it's clear he's dead anyway, so there's no point, just leave her alone to be with her husband. And Clint Hill, finally, after many seconds of Secret Service agents begging and pleading for Jackie to release the president so they could try to save his life, realizes what is going on. He takes off his suit coat, covers up the president's destroyed head and chest so that the witnesses in the area will not see Jack Kennedy in such a state, at which point Jackie finally lets him go and they're able to rush him into the hospital emergency room. In the emergency room, Dr. Charles Carrico, in Trauma Room 1, they call it, is the first one on the scene. He is an internist at this point, I believe, but he is responsible at this point for assessing Kennedy because he is the only one available. In his words, the president is, quote, blue, white, ashen, end quote, which is an indication of failing blood circulation. His respiration is slow, agonal, which is the correct and scientific term for the death rattle, and spasmodic with no coordination. There is no voluntary movement in the president, and there is no reaction to light. Pupils are dilated with no palpable pulse. Obviously, this is about as bad as it can get for a gunshot victim. Carrico puts his ear to Kennedy's chest and does detect a very faint heartbeat, and his primary agenda at this point now is to restore breathing and circulation. So Carrico puts a tube down the president's windpipe and orders doctors Don Curtis and Martin White to perform a cutdown. A cutdown is a procedure that was used back in the 60s and 70s. It's not used much anymore, but it was an incision in the ankle that would open up a small vein into which a catheter could be inserted to deliver fluid, medicine, and blood transfusions quickly into the system in hopes of restarting the circulation and saving the president's life. At this point, Dr. Malcolm Perry and Dr. Ronald Jones arrive and Perry takes control. While all this is happening, at 12:43 p.m., Attorney General and brother to the president, Robert Kennedy, is at home with U.S. Attorney Robert Morgenthau having a working lunch when the phone rings and his wife, Ethel, answers it and tells Bobby that J. Edgar Hoover is on the line. Now, J. Edgar Hoover and Bobby Kennedy did not get along at all. Bobby immediately has a bad feeling that it can only be bad news with J. Edgar Hoover calling him at his home. He picks up the phone and hears, quote, I have news for you. The president's been shot. It's believed to be fatal. I'll call you back when I find out more. End quote. J. Edgar Hoover was not a warm and compassionate man, as is plainly clear from this quote, but also in just his general life. Trauma Room 2, back in Parkland Hospital, Dr. Robert Shaw is attending to Governor Connolly. It is fairly clear that Governor Connolly needs emergency surgery, but he is less grievously wounded than the president. He is soon transported upstairs to a regular operating room to go under the knife, and he will be saved. Back in Trauma Room 1, a respirator and an endotracheal tube is inadequate for Kennedy's respiration, so Perry can see air leaking from a small hole in the throat. He asks Carrico if he had started a tracheotomy, and Carrico says no, the hole in the throat is a wound. It is just below and to the right of the president's Adam's apple. Dr. Perry performs a tracheotomy directly over top of the wound in hopes of getting better respiration to the president. At this point, the Trauma Room 1 is filled with doctors who are there to help. One of them is Dr. William Kemp Clark. He is Parkland's senior neurosurgeon. Incisions are made in the chest to insert a tube to drain blood or air from the chest cavity, and other doctors are performing more cutdowns on the arms and legs to get as many fluids and blood into the president's circulatory system as possible. Dr. Clark is examining the head wound. He exchanges a glance with Dr. Perry, and they will later say in interviews they both knew that the president could not be saved, but they had to go through the motions and do everything possible and hope for a miracle. While doctors are working on the president, Jackie Kennedy insists on being in the room, which seems like a horrible idea, but eventually, through the intervention of the president's personal physician, a man named Admiral Berkeley. It's not his name. His rank is Admiral, and his last name is Berkeley. I cannot remember his first name. I apologize. He uses his power, basically, to get Jackie into the room where she kind of, in a daze, is walking around until she gets to a Dr. Jenkins. She has her hands cupped in front of her. She gives Dr. Jenkins a nudge and then hands him something, which when he looks at it, he discovers it to be a large chunk of brain tissue from the president, which he gives to a nurse. So yes, she was not exaggerating when she said that she had his brains in her hands. Meanwhile, back at Dealey Plaza, Lee Harvey Oswald has gotten out of the school book depository, the Texas school book depository. He has slipped past the police officers in the quarantine. I believe he talked his way out of it because he's an employee and he needed to leave, and the police officers didn't think anything of it because he just was a normal worker. So he gets out of the depository and gets on a bus, which is quickly stuck in traffic, causing Oswald to get off and make his way on foot until he can find another means of transport. Back at the depository, Howard Brennan is brought to Inspector J. Herbert Sawyer. He was an eyewitness, and he is going to the inspector to give his report. Sawyer is on the police radio and sends out what Brennan tells him. Quote, attention all squads, attention all squads. The suspect in the shooting at Elm in Houston is reported to be an unknown white male, approximately 30, slender build, height 5 feet 10 inches, weight 165 pounds, reported to be armed with what is thought to be a 30 caliber rifle, end quote. Apparently, I cannot say caliber. Notice that the description is a very good match to Lee Harvey Oswald, but also notice it is a very close match to what Arnold Roland saw before the chaos started happening after the gunshots. At this point, Oswald gets into a cab driven by William Whaley, and he's about four blocks south of Elm Street. Whaley takes Oswald to the Oak Cliff neighborhood of Dallas. Police radio dispatcher Murray Jackson saw that many of the officers from the Oak Cliff area are heading downtown to help out at Dealey Plaza, and he, being the experienced dispatcher that he is, realizes that if there's a major accident or someone takes advantage of the chaos and tries to do some sort of armed robbery or other mischief, there will be no patrolmen in the area. So Murray Jackson decides to pull Units 78 and 87 closer to Oak Cliff just in case. The men in those units are officers J.D. Tippett and Ronald Nelson. Now at this point, it is 12:50 p.m. Forrest Sorrells, the Secret Service agent in charge of the Dallas office, wants the name and address of everyone who works at the Texas School Book Depository. Now, he is not doing this because he is aware that there were shots fired from the building. He is doing it solely because everybody in that building is a potential witness to the crime, and he wants to make sure that he gets statements from those present. At 12:52 p.m., Oswald is dropped off by William Whaley after about a 2.5-mile trip in the cab. And it's interesting and important to note that he is not dropped off right at the address that he lives at, but instead he has Whaley go about a block down the road where he gets out and then walks back to his boarding house. Suspicious behavior, to say the least. Now at 12:57 p.m., Connolly begins anesthesia to begin an operation that will last about 3 hours or so. Connolly has a roughly elliptical entrance wound just behind his right armpit, and the exit wound on his chest is larger and ragged, and it is just below the right nipple. His fifth rib has been shattered, damaged to the right lung, and his wounds are very serious but not fatal. Connolly will survive after having the operation. It's also important to note that he has wounds on both sides of his right wrist and superficial wound in his left thigh. Following up in the next episode, I will go through and explain all of the wounds in detail and why they are where they are and how they occurred. Oswald goes back to his boarding house. His boarding house is at 1026 North Beckley Avenue in the Oak Cliff area of Dallas. He is not there long. He rushes in, gets his revolver, and changes his coat and rushes out. Again, suspicious behavior to say the least. 1 p.m., Dr. Kemp Clark feels for a pulse in the president's neck and feels nothing. Clark asks for a cardiotachyscope, I think is how you pronounce that. I am really stretching my medical vernacular here. It is a device to measure heartbeat, and it is connected to the president. He starts external heart massage, which eventually Dr. Perry takes over. The cardiotachyscope shows not even a squiggle of cardiac activity. Dr. Clark shakes his head and says to Dr. Perry, quote, "It's too late, Mac," end quote. Perry walks away from the body as Dr. Jenkins pulls a white sheet up over the president's face. Dr. Clark goes over to Jackie Kennedy, says, quote, "Your husband has sustained a fatal wound," end quote. Jackie, overcome with grief, cannot get the words out, but she mouths, "I know." Dr. Clark will sign the death certificate, the cause being obviously massive trauma to the right side of the brain caused by a gunshot wound. And for all intents and purposes, the president was dead on arrival, basically dead in the instant that the third bullet hit. But of course, being the president of the United States, every effort had to be tried before they could pronounce him dead. Now at this point, after rushing over to the hospital, Father Oscar Huber enters the room, draws back the sheets, and administers in Latin the last rites, followed by a recitation of the Lord's Prayer and a Hail Mary. Obviously, being a Catholic, it is extremely important to, especially their surviving family, that Kennedy receive what the Catholic Church calls extreme unction. Now, there is different interpretations of the last rites in the Catholic Church. Fortunately for Jackie Kennedy, or maybe solely for Jackie Kennedy's benefit, Father Oscar Huber was a bit more lenient in his views, and he assured Jackie Kennedy that he was positive that the president's soul had not left his body despite the fact that he was pronounced dead, and therefore the last rites were valid. The last rites are not a long ceremony. And it is because it was so short and sweet, bittersweet, I should say, that Admiral Buckley especially was somewhat offended. It was the President of the United States, and that ceremony just didn't seem sufficient to him. Therefore, that is why Father Oscar Huber led them in prayer of the Lord's Prayer and said the Hail Mary. At 1:05 p.m., Robert Kennedy is informed that his brother is dead. It sends him into a depression in which he never fully recovers, and he spends the rest of his life wearing his brother's clothes and basically in a bit of a sad state of affairs until he has his own date with tragedy in his own assassination. 1:06 p.m., detectives and police officers are searching the depository on the seventh floor. They quickly figure out that nothing happened there, so they begin systematically searching lower down, obviously starting with the sixth floor. Deputy Luke Mooney is near the southeastern corner when he whistles his colleagues over. He is inside the discovered sniper nest, which is constructed of boxes stacked around the southeasternmost window. Anyone crouching or sitting would be hidden from anyone else on that floor, and there are two boxes on top of each other in front of the window, which would obviously be used to steady a high-powered rifle. In the corner, a long, handmade brown paper bag is crumpled up, and it was obviously used to transport the rifle. And I would have you note that Wesley Frazier has said multiple times that Lee Harvey Oswald was bringing, quote-unquote, curtain rods to work that day in a long homemade brown paper bag. There are also three spent cartridge casings on the floor below the window. At 1:08 p.m., Officer J.D. Tippett in the central Oak Cliff area spots a man that vaguely matches the physical description of the assassin. Now, obviously, at this point, he does not know who this man is. We now know that it was Lee Harvey Oswald. And he begins to slowly tail Oswald, who is walking, while trying to reach dispatch for a better description of the assassin, if possible, but he cannot get through to the dispatcher. 1:10 p.m., Ken O'Donnell informs Vice President Lyndon Johnson that Kennedy is dead and that, for all intents and purposes, Johnson is now the President of the United States. We are getting to the point in the episode where things happen rapidly. That's why I'm mentioning it's basically almost a minute-by-minute breakdown from here on out. Now, Johnson does not want the announcement to be made officially that Kennedy is dead until he is back on Air Force One. At this point, and I cannot stress this enough, that there is no evidence of this, and that this was all just conjecture made in the heat of the moment by men who were under an intense amount of physical, emotional, and mental stress. But Johnson does not want the announcement to be made because, as he says to the Secret Service agent, they do not know what happened to Kennedy, and it could be that it was a communist hit job, or that it was the USSR, or the KGB, or somebody, and it could be part of a larger plot. Again, I am stressing that this is what Johnson said in the heat of the moment. Therefore, he does not want the announcement to be made until he is in an area that is safe. Unfortunately, Johnson will not leave without Jackie, and Jackie will not leave without Jack's body. So it's turning into a giant cluster. 1:11 p.m., William Scoggins, a cab driver who is eating lunch, sees J.D. Tippett stop his patrol car next to an unidentified man in a light-colored jacket who is walking on the sidewalk. Now, from now on, I am going to refer to the quote-unquote unidentified man as Lee Harvey Oswald because now we know that's who it was. But just keep in mind, at this point, the witnesses did not know who this man was. Nobody did. He was a nobody at this point. As Tippett gets out of his car, he is keeping an eye on Oswald, but he has not drawn his weapon, and he seems to be fairly at ease, seems a routine stop. Oswald sees Tippett walking. He takes two steps back, pulls a revolver from under his jacket, and fires. Scoggins sees Tippett grab his stomach and fall to the ground. Another witness, a man named Jack Ray Tatum, is driving his truck. He had just passed the patrol car when the shots rang out. He looks back, sees Tippett on the ground. Tatum then sees Oswald start heading in his direction. Hesitate, takes a step back into the street, fires one more shot directly into the head of Tippett, and then takes off. In a nearby house, sisters Barbara and Virginia Davis are babysitting when they hear the shots. They hear another witness named Helen Markham start screaming, "He killed him." Barbara sees the police car and the man with a gun less than 25 feet away, cutting across her front yard, and she runs to the phone and calls the police. Helen Markham rushes over to Tippett, but it is clear that he cannot be saved. He is dead. At 1:16 p.m., CBS News anchor Walter Cronkite, in a breaking news bulletin, interrupts the CBS broadcast of the soap opera As the World Turns and informs the nation that the president has reportedly died, but calls it, quote, only a rumor. He's not even on camera at this point. They had rushed to get the news out so quickly, and the technology of that time, the cameras needed about 15 minutes to warm up. It is literally just audio with a breaking news bulletin banner on the screen. 1:20 p.m., Parkland Hospital engineer Daryl Tomlinson notices a gurney that has been left in the hallway of the ground floor. As he pushes it away so that he can use the elevator, he hears a metal-on-metal clink, sees a bullet lying between the pad and the rim of the gurney. Tomlinson calls over the personnel officer of Parkland, a man named O.P. Wright, and tries to get somebody to take a look at the bullet. Reluctantly, Wright, who is a former police officer, picks up the bullet and puts it in his pocket for the next half hour or so until he finally passes it off to Richard E. Johnson of the Secret Service, and later this bullet will become a key piece of evidence. Despite not knowing who has the jurisdiction, the FBI is now involved, offering any and all assistance to the Secret Service, and FBI offices start to establish the whereabouts of anyone who may have been involved in this assassination based on information in the FBI files. 1:22 p.m., police continue to search the sixth floor of the depository while crime lab techs work in the sniper's nest. In the northwest corner, Deputy Eugene Boone and Deputy Constable Seymour Weitzman are searching every nook and cranny possible. Between the two rows of boxes with another box slid at an angle over top of it, the men finally find the rifle. 1:23 p.m. at Methodist Hospital, a Dr. Richard LaCorey declares Officer J.D. Tippett dead on arrival. The body is transported to Parkland for an autopsy, but before that happens, 1.38 caliber slug is removed from his body to determine what kind of gun was used. 1:26 p.m., Secret Service agents get two unmarked police cars to get Johnson, now president, back to Love Field and Air Force One. And 1:29 p.m., Dallas police start to learn that there might be a connection between the Kennedy assassination and the murder of J.D. Tippett, based mostly on the fact that the descriptions of both of the people involved match. 1:30 p.m., Vernon O'Neill, a funeral home owner, brings a casket to Parkland. The coffin is lined with plastic. Kennedy's body is wrapped in a sheet and loaded into the casket. However, trouble ensues at this point because Dr. Earl Rose tells the Secret Service they cannot take the body. He is the Dallas County Medical Examiner, and he will not let the body leave until an autopsy is performed, since it was a homicide. Dr. Rose and Roy Kellerman, Secret Service, get into a heated argument, despite the fact that legally speaking, Dr. Rose is correct, but as Kellerman and others argue this is an extraordinary situation, the law does not apply. Simultaneously, police officers have discovered that Lee Harvey Oswald is not at the Texas School Book Depository despite working there, and suspicions start to arise. At 1:33 p.m., Malcolm Kilduff, the assistant White House press secretary, but the ranking press secretary for this particular trip, makes the official announcement now that Johnson has left that Kennedy has died. The reporters all pretty much knew because the priests that came to the hospital told them, but nothing had been official until this announcement by Kilduff. Mistakenly, Kilduff, in his initial statement, tells reporters that no one else in the limo was hit. We obviously know that was false, but Kilduff, being under extreme amount of pressure and emotional grief, makes that mistake. At 1:36 p.m., witnesses see, quote, a suspicious man, Oswald, duck into the Texas Theater without buying a ticket. And at the same time, Johnson is now back at Air Force One and trying to figure out how and when to take the oath of office to make sure that it's legal and expedient. Jumping ahead to 1:50 p.m., Dallas patrolmen Nick McDonald, C.T. Walker, Ray Hawkins, and Thomas Hudson are at the Texas Theater where witnesses point out Oswald. McDonald approaches him. He orders him to his feet. Oswald initially obeys and starts to raise his hand while other officers are approaching from the opposite side. Oswald says, "Well, it's all over now," and with his left fist punches McDonald directly between the eyes. McDonald tumbles down but grabs Oswald, who lands on top of him, starts holding him down, and reaches for something in his waistband. Other officers grab Oswald and pull him off McDonald. At this point, Oswald has his revolver out and is waving it around, clearly trying to get a shot off. And officers are doing what they can to make sure that doesn't happen, including punching and hitting him in the back of the head with a shotgun butt. At one point, I believe McDonald says he was holding on to the revolver and he felt and heard the trigger get pulled. And from what he described, it sounded like the hammer of the revolver hit the skin between his thumb and forefinger and therefore did not go off. Officers finally subdue Oswald and search him for ID. They find one ID that says Lee Oswald, but then they also find his ID under the alias AJ Hiddle. Oswald will not confirm which one is the real one, and witnesses say that he shows zero emotion as he is being let out. 2:04 p.m., tempers are heated at the hospital. Dr. Rose still impeding the Secret Service from taking Kennedy's body. Theron Ward is a justice of the peace who has shown up and could overrule Dr. Rose legally, but he sides with Dr. Rose and is preventing the presidential party from taking Kennedy's body from the hospital. Ken O'Donnell, obviously under a huge amount of stress and grieving because not only was he the advisor to the president, he was also one of the president's best friends, is begging Theron Ward to make an exception because it is the president of the United States who is in the casket. And Theron Ward quite coldly responds, "It's just another homicide case as far as I'm concerned," which is the last straw for Ken O'Donnell, who responds, "Go f*** yourself, we're leaving." And Secret Service and presidential aides force the medical examiner and police officers out of the way and forcibly remove the president's body. Ward calls District Attorney Henry Wade and is surprised to learn that Wade has no problem with the president's body being removed. At 2:14 p.m., Secret Service, Jackie, presidential aides, and the casket arrive at Love Field, nervous because they are expecting police to show up at any time to enforce the legal need for an autopsy. They get the casket to the steps that are up to the rear entrance of Air Force One. Unfortunately, the casket is wider than the steps to the rear entrance, and it takes an incredible amount of finagling and just brute force to get the casket onto the airplane. At 2:38 p.m. in a crowded Air Force One, Federal District Judge Sarah Hughes administers the oath of office to Lyndon Johnson, who becomes the 36th President of the United States. Jackie Kennedy is to Johnson's left. She is still wearing the pink Chanel suit and white gloves that she was wearing on the motorcade, and they are still caked with her husband's blood. At one point during the day, I don't know if it's during this time of the oath of office or if it was later when they get to Washington, someone asked her if she wanted to change. She said, and I'm paraphrasing here because I didn't write it down, "No, I want them to see what they've done." Johnson finally orders Air Force One to take off, and they head for Washington. Now, I'm going to say skimming here, even though I'm still going to go into quite a bit of detail. There is mounds of information in terms of people questioning Oswald, the FBI getting involved, all the questioning that goes back and forth between Oswald and the Dallas police. I'm not going to get into it. It's too much of the nitty-gritty even for me to get into this podcast. It would take 4 or 5 hours legitimately to get into all of that. So I'm skipping most of that. We'll go over things in brief in other episodes. So we're going to just start skimming around a little bit here until we get to the pertinent details. So throughout the rest of the day, it's total chaos at the police headquarters and the FBI headquarters. Oswald is questioned. One thing everybody can agree on is that despite his protestations, Lee Harvey Oswald is the prime suspect in the Kennedy assassination from the get-go. It's only been about 2 to 3 hours since the shots rang out, and the police are fairly convinced that they have their guy. Dr. Malcolm Perry and Dr. William Kemp Clark give a press conference at the hospital. It's an impromptu press conference. They were not totally prepared for it. It was difficult for them to answer questions because there are so many reporters there screaming questions at them that as they are trying to answer one question, someone is already asking a follow-up question and things get confused easily. And at one point, Perry says that he believes that the throat wound that he enlarged to make the tracheotomy was an entrance wound. Obviously, as I will show you in the next episode, this was false, but with no confirmation and because of the chaos and everything that was happening, newspapers take this as gospel truth and they print it, and conspiracy theories blow up in the future because of this misinformation. 3:30 p.m., detectives arrive at Ruth Payne's house in Irving, Texas, where Marina Oswald is staying. Detective Guy Rose asks Marina if her husband had a rifle. Marina does not speak much English, so Ruth Payne translates for the detective. Now, earlier, after news broke that there was an assassination attempt, Marina had gone to the garage to look for the rifle. Immediately, she was suspicious of Oswald, which is telling. She had seen that Oswald kept the rifle in a blanket in the garage, and when she went into the garage, she saw the blanket, and because it had somewhat retained the shape of a rifle, she was satisfied that the rifle was still there, never touched the blanket, and felt much relief. So she takes the detectives into the garage, sure that she is about to exonerate her husband from all suspicion, and points out the blanket to the detective. The detective picks up the blanket, which, being empty, falls loosely over his arm, and Marina lets out an audible gasp. She says in later episodes that that was the moment that she knew that her husband was guilty. But it is important that I point out that she later recanted that, and in much later years maintains that her husband was set up, based on flimsy evidence and what I suspect is emotional attachment. Again, we'll get to that. 4:58 p.m., Air Force One lands at Andrews Air Force Base, and because John F. Kennedy was a naval officer, Jackie decides that they will take his body to Bethesda Naval Hospital, which they do at 6:35 p.m., and hospital autopsy pathologist Commander James Humes, and Commander J. Thornton Boswell begin the autopsy of the former president, into which detail I will get in the next episode. Now, skipping ahead, that is it for events that I found pertinent for November 22, 1963, but we cannot possibly talk about the events that happened in Dallas without skipping ahead a couple days to November 24, 1963. That's a Sunday. Now, Oswald has spent these days being questioned, and he's not very cooperative, but police are confident that they have their man, and that if this will go to trial, that it will be fairly easy to prove his guilt. But the decision is made to transfer Lee Harvey Oswald from the Dallas Police Headquarters to a more secure location at the county jail. And it's a very public transfer. The Dallas police are not used to this type of publicity. They do not have the manpower or the knowledge of how to deal with these types of situations. So they made some mistakes. It is not their fault necessarily, but it's just the way things happened. So being a very public transfer and being in the late morning around 11:20, press is allowed into the basement to witness the transfer, despite the fact that the police have gotten threats against Oswald. 11:20 a.m. live on TV and radio, Oswald is brought into the basement of Dallas headquarters. He is handcuffed to a detective named Jim Lavelle, and as Oswald is led past reporter Ike Pappas, who shouts, "Do you have anything to say in your defense?" A man in a hat lunges from the crowd with a gun in his right hand. Now, one of the detectives who's part of the protective detail for Lee Harvey Oswald, Detective Billy Combest, recognizes the man as Jack Ruby and shouts, "Jack, you son of a bitch, don't." 11:21 a.m., live on TV, Jack Ruby claiming rage at the president's death and hoping to be a hero, and also probably, most likely, mentally ill. Jack Ruby shoots Lee Harvey Oswald in the abdomen with a .38 revolver. Oswald is rushed to Parkland Hospital Trauma Room 2, where he is worked on by the same doctors who tried to save the president on Friday, including Malcolm Perry. And while doctors are trying to save Oswald's life, many in the country are watching the funeral of Kennedy. Almost exactly to the hour of Kennedy's death at 1:07 p.m. on Sunday, November 24, 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald dies from his wounds. Jack Ruby is convicted of, quote, murder with malice, end quote, and is sentenced to death. However, in 1966, the Texas Court of Appeals deems that Ruby could not have gotten a fair trial in Dallas at the time, declares a mistrial, and sets a date for a retrial. But while waiting for that retrial in January of 1967, Ruby dies of lung cancer in Dallas. Now, many people think that Ruby killing Oswald was a cover-up for a conspiracy, but we are going to dive into next episode the mountains of evidence that prove definitively that there was no conspiracy, no other shooters, and that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone in killing the 35th President of the United States, John F. Kennedy. So join me next time. I'm Brett Bielsma. I am the host of the Curiosity Chronicles, and I hope that you stay curious.